open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
Michigan football is a religion, and Saturday is the holy day of obligation.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Today, John U. Bacon tells the story of meeting with legendary University of Michigan coach Bo Schembechler after writing an article about Michigan football.
So I sit down, I feel like a 10-year-old kid again, and I'm shrinking in my chair, and he stares at me for about a month, it felt like. And he finally says some words I'll never forget as long as I live. He says, "Well, Bacon, you didn't screw it up, and frankly, I'm surprised."
John U. Bacon has covered sports for various newspapers, and he's written numerous books about University of Michigan athletics. His latest book is End Zone: The Rise, Fall, and Return of Michigan Football. Bacon got his start in journalism when Detroit news editor Bob Giles gave him his break. Before that, Bacon was in law school, but he wanted to be a writer. So, he says, he made a deal with himself.
I said, you give yourself 3 years, same as law school. At the end of 3 years, if you're not going to make it, by then you'll probably know. At that point, you need to go back to law school. That was the deal I made with myself. Near the end of that is when I got a call from the Detroit News asking me to put my hat in the ring for a position at the Detroit News. I'd written about a half dozen or so magazine articles for national magazines and done some work for the Ann Arbor News and some other publications, but nothing very major. A bit of high school stuff for the Detroit News. But one of my editors there, Jim Russ, a great friend of mine, a great ally, great mentor, he said, "You got to try out for this." So I said, "Okay." This job, I have to tell you, though, is a notch below columnist at the seventh biggest paper in the nation at that time. All right, you usually start out doing high school and then college and then pro beats and then some other stuff. Then you might get to this position, and then the next stop is columnist. Bob, with no experience really, no full-time experience anywhere, slotted me into that position. And I cannot tell you what that meant to me, what an amazing chance that was, and what an incredible risk it was for Bob Giles to do that for me. Bob gave me, and his editors gave me, 2.5 pages in the Detroit News on a Sunday. No one gets that now in the Detroit News, in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, anywhere. I got the middle window, nice photo. I got 2 full pages inside, no ads, what's called the double truck. And that showed a ton of confidence. That story comes out. It finished top 10 nationwide. On the state, I finished second behind Mitch Albom for the third straight year, but I'm not bitter. In the state of Michigan, we're all fighting for the silver medal, by the way, just for the record. I got on WJR and some TV and all this other stuff, but on Monday, I didn't hear anything from Bo, but I figured, okay, we're all busy. On Tuesday, I still didn't hear anything from Bo. I figured, okay, well, no big deal. Wednesday, I'm getting nervous. Thursday, I cannot take it anymore. I figure he must be white hot, ticked off about something. I've got to be a man and find out what it is. So I put on my coat and tie. I marched myself on down to Schembechler Hall with no appointment. And I was outside Bo's office talking to Mary Passink, his longtime secretary, a great person. And I have to ask her, "How's Bo doing?" And then Bo Schembechler yells from his office with the door open, "Bacon, is that you?" "Yes, get in here." It's like, okay, this is not good. I start walking into Bo's office. He gets out of his chair and walks behind me, which is pretty rare. He slams the big heavy wooden door shut. And then as I'm walking into the office, I hear the tumbler turn over. He has locked the damn door. That is definitely not good. And he says, "Sit down." So I sit down. I feel like a 10-year-old kid again, and I'm shrinking in my chair. And he goes around to his chair, and he stares at me for about a month, it felt like. And he finally says some words I'll never forget as long as I live. He says, "Well, Bacon, you didn't screw it up, and frankly, I'm surprised." To this day, I've never gotten a better compliment in my life. "Really? Do you mean that, Coach? You're not just saying that, right?" Now on to the work at hand, and that is End Zone, of course, The Rise, Fall, and Return of Michigan Football. I got a lot of questions about that title during the summer when I started writing this, but before I got to there, this book started in October of 2014, almost exactly a year ago. I was out in New York talking to my agent. We were having breakfast, and he said, this very good Ben Adams, a very good publisher, editor, wanted me to write another book about Michigan football. Now, at that time, Michigan was 2-4, fresh off the Shane Morris game, which was a big national crisis, obviously, for Michigan football. They had a rally on campus to get the AD fired, the first one I've ever seen like that. And I tell my agent, not only do I not want to write that book, I don't think I want to read that book. And they said, no, we're talking about the off-the-field stuff you're already writing about, the student ticket prices, the budget I've been writing about, the AD tug-of-war between the fans and all that. I said, well, maybe that could be a book. So I started writing a proposal in mid-October. When I finished in early December, all right, Dave Brandon had resigned, Brady Hoke, the coach, had been fired, Jim Hackett, the interim AD, had been hired, and he's hot in the heels of a guy named Jim Harbaugh, and I'm thinking, yes, we have a book here. The Rise, I think almost any sports fan knows how Michigan succeeded on and off pretty much, of course, but pretty much nonstop from 1879 when the program started all the way to 2010, really till 2008, I guess, when Rich Rodriguez took over and the team started losing some games. But the Rise, of course, is Feeling Yost, Fritz Kreisler, and Bo Schembechler. And I can prove this, by the way, and one of my big theses, if you will, of this book is that if you are running an athletic department at Michigan State, and Mark Hollis, I think, is doing a fantastic job. If he's not the best AD in the country, he's damn close, all right? Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, a place like this, Notre Dame. You better understand that, yes, you need sound business practices. You need a CFO, you need attorneys, you need HR and all that, but you better not think for a second that you're actually running a business, because the people who give you all that money, the students, the fans, the alumni, the donors and all that, they see what you're doing as a religion, not a business, and you need to understand that. I can prove that a few different ways. One is the great line from Bob Eufer, of course, the longtime voice of Michigan football, who said that Michigan football is a religion and Saturday is the holy day of obligation. You can't write that stuff. That's the legend himself. And one tenet of religion, this is lowercase r, of course, not a big capital. Real religion, naturally, is a secular thing. The values get passed down from generation to generation, from person to person. I can show that when Bo Schembechler shows up in January of 1969. And Michigan at that point had won one Big Ten title in 18 years. Michigan State was riding high, of course, during that era as well. And Michigan had a $300,000 deficit. The facilities were shambles. So his coaches get up there from Miami of Ohio, and they'd been at Ohio State previously. And they are on the second floor of Yost Fieldhouse, is where you got dressed for football practice. They've got rusty nails, they got rusty chairs, and Jerry Hanlon says, holy mackerel, this is Michigan? We had better stuff at Miami. And Bo, of course, hears this, his head whips around, and he cuts it off at the pass, and he says, better stuff at Miami? You see that rusty nail right there? Feeling Yost hung his hat on that rusty nail. You see that rusty chair right there? Feeling Yost sat in that rusty chair. And you're going to tell me that we had better stuff at Miami? No, we didn't, men. We've got tradition here, Michigan tradition, and that is something that nobody else has. End of conversation. By the way, if Bo yelled in your ear as he did mine for 10 years, you could do that too. So that's how it gets passed down. Don Canham understood that intrinsically, I believe. The AD from 1968 to 1988, one of the best in the business of all time, I think. He understood a few different things. One, his first job was to fill the big house any way he could. When he took over in 1969, 1968, Michigan was averaging 60,000 fans a game. In other words, half the game, the games were basically half full throughout the season on average. It's pretty incredible. After the great 1969 victory over Ohio State, I think to this day the biggest win in Michigan football history. Bo Cannon was so nervous about selling all the tickets for that game, incredibly, that he'd go to Toledo and dump off about 20 or 30,000 tickets to Buckeye fans. So you had a ton of red in the stadium that day, and even after Bo had this great win, Bo had the nerve, if you will, to still be pissed off about that on Monday. So he marches in to Canham's office, says, damn it, Canham, I saw too much red in that stadium. Don't you ever do that to me again. And Canham motions to a chair, and he pulls a cigar out of the box. He offers Bo one. He puts his feet on the table, and he says, Bo, after Saturday, I never will again. Winning solves a lot of problems. One key to that was his simple idea called the scarcity principle. And how that works is this. When things are scarce, you want it more badly, of course. You want it more seriously than you would have before. If there's plenty of whatever it is, you don't care about it that much. How many of you heard today, by the way, or yesterday, whatever else, that tickets are going fast for this thing? I hope you did, because if so, it worked. I am a big adherent of the scarcity principle, of course, on all the radio stations, Ron Jelly and all the rest. We kept on talking about this great crowd tonight. We appreciate that. So his whole day was to fill the house no matter what. And after that, he had a wait list of 10, 20, 30,000 fans waiting to get into Michigan Stadium. Pretty incredible wait list. And Econ 101, which I did take at Michigan, didn't do very well, but did okay in it, tells you a very simple principle. If you're running the Park Place Hotel and you're at 100% capacity all the time, you've not charged enough. You don't know what the paying threshold is. You need to increase the price until you get about a 95% threshold of capacity, and now you're making a lot more money than you would with lower prices. And as Canham told me, that's a fine thing if you're running, say, a hotel, but not if you're running a football stadium. Everyone here can stay home and watch on TV. Why do you come to the games? One reason is you know if you drop your tickets, you ain't going to get them again. All right, 20,000 or 30,000 deep is how far the waitlist went. He told all his ticket managers during those years, Al Renfrew and Marty Bodner and all the rest, that make sure the day after the applications are due, all right, the next 2 days, don't schedule anything. Because all you're going to be doing is answering panicked phone calls from season ticket holders saying, please don't drop my tickets. All right, that's how terrified you are of losing them. I can prove that also. That somewhere around 79 or 80, I believe it was, Bo had lost five straight Rose Bowls at that point, and one longtime ticket holder wrote down Canham a letter and said, dear Mr. Canham, I can't take this anymore. I'm tired of the bowl losses. Please rescind my application for tickets this year. And Mr. Canham writes him back a nice cordial letter saying, I'm sorry you feel this way, sir. We'll honor your wishes. Best wishes to you. And a week later, Canham gets back another letter, same letterhead, same address, different handwriting. He opens it up and it says, dear Mr. Canham, please don't listen to Mr. Knucklehead. That is my husband. The tickets are mine. That is how the scarcity principle works. That's what Canham did. Bill Martin picked up where Canham left off, in my opinion. Taking over in 2000, he had a $3 million debt. The facilities had not been updated again in about 10 or 15 years, and Michigan has headed towards probation on basketball. So 10 years later, the program returns over to Dave Brennan in 2010, turned a $3 million deficit into a $50 million surplus, plus an annual operating budget surplus of $10 million a year, about 20% of the budget per year, incredibly, and $400 million invested already in 14 new or renovated buildings on their campus, covering almost all of the 26 sports Michigan had at the time. That's football, basketball, hockey, tennis, women's gymnastics, softball, baseball, almost a whole lot. That is almost a gold-plated program. On top of that, Michigan was the only team in the North to finish in the top six nationwide in what's called the Director's Cup, which keeps track of all the sports in all and across the country, women's and men's. All right, Stanford always wins this. Texas is always up there. UCLA is up there. Michigan's the only Big Ten team to really be close at that point. That is damn near a gold-plated program at that point. So that's what Brandon inherits in 2010. Now, like almost everyone else, I thought Dave Brandon was going to be a great success at Michigan. And there's a lot of reason to think that. He'd played football for Bo in the 70s. He and Bo were so close that the night before Bo died, his last dinner was with Dave Brandon and Andrew Fisher Newman, a respected regent from the Republican side at Michigan. Bo died the next day. Brandon was also a hotshot CEO at Velasquez and then Domino's Pizza. And perhaps most importantly, he was an outstanding regent at the University of Michigan. Not good, not great, but outstanding. And I got that, and it's in the book, from Democrats, Republicans alike, from provosts, from deans, from guys who run the hospital. He did an outstanding job as regent. When he takes over, you figure, this has got to work. And for the first year, it really did. He insisted on running a scrupulously clean program. No drugs, no money changing hands, no plagiarized papers, of course. So it was, throughout his time, a very clean program. He was also very close to the student athletes. He'd take the teams out for dinner to get to know them better. He'd also go to your games and your practices even, and not just for football and basketball, but women's field hockey, men's tennis, you name it. He also brought the first night game in to Michigan Stadium in 2011, which ABC had been wanting for so long, that Dave Brandon got ABC to pay for half the price of installing the lights, and Michigan kept the lights. So that's pretty good. That's a good businessman right there. And of course, Brady Hoke's first season, they're 11-2, and everybody's happy. But things start going wrong internally and then externally. It's basically the epicenter of an earthquake. The people inside felt it first, and then ring two, three, and four, and finally ring five, which we all saw in October of 2014, actually September 29th, the famous Shane Morris Minnesota football game last year. He was diagnosed with a probable mild concussion. As a friend of mine said, who's down there at the athletic department, he said, "I'm not a doctor, but I can tell you what a probable mild concussion is. It's a headache." All right? It's obviously to be taken seriously at all times, but these things happen all the time in football. Why was it? How was it that a probable mild concussion, a very small thing on the grand scale, was enough to be the spark to take down the forest that was Michigan football during that season and the entire department, really? All right, I'll tell you how it was. My analogy here is Hurricane Katrina. In 2005, of course, the hurricane hits. We all know about that. What you probably don't know about is 5 years earlier, friends of mine at the New Orleans Times-Picayune, a great newspaper, did an exhaustive investigative series saying that we are not ready for the next once-in-a-lifetime hurricane. We're overdue for one. They happen about every 50 years. When it happens, our levees aren't ready, our staff is not ready, our budget's not ready, our protocols are not in place. We are going to get literally swamped by the next once-in-a-lifetime hurricane. And no one listened, and of course, 5 years later, that's exactly what happened. And the temptation is to blame the hurricane. But the hurricane was predicted, and so was the disaster that followed. What happened was, when the weather's good, all the safeguards in place for decades to save New Orleans from that hurricane were removed one by one by one, to finally a world-class hurricane can wipe it out, at least for a little while. All right, Michigan's situation was so insane, in my opinion, that a probable mild concussion was enough to do the job. How'd that happen? First was the employees. Dave Brandon inherited 260 employees from Bill Martin. Right, they created that gold-plated department. Within 4 years, of the 260 employees, 143, more than half, were gone. All right, resigned, forced resigned, or fired. In that process, you lost centuries of institutional knowledge. And almost always you hired people from the outside, often from the pro ranks, the New York Knicks, the Washington Redskins, the Colts, the Pistons, all sent people to Michigan to work in place of these long-standing employees. In the process also, get this. When Rick Leach, I would argue one of the three greatest athletes in the history of Michigan athletics, Benny Oosterbaum in the 20s, Ron Kramer in the 50s, Rick Leach, a three-time Heisman Trophy finalist who played 10 years for the Detroit Tigers and the Blue Jays in baseball, that's how good an athlete he was. He calls up to renew his tickets, and the person on the phone asked him how to spell Leach. You've lost something at that point. So you've lost the employees, you lose the Letterman next. A lot of different ways he lost them, but one simple way was, before the 2011 Notre Dame game, for decades, if you're a letterman at Michigan, Burkholder here in Traverse City, of course, as well as others, all you had to do for years, if you needed tickets for a game and you're out of town, just call up Michigan, call up Jamie Morris, your old buddy, your old teammate, or Marty Bodner, the old basketball player running the ticket department, and ask for a couple tickets. They never asked for them to be free, and they never were free. It's always face value, nothing more, nothing less. And they weren't necessarily great tickets either. There are two tickets in the corner or down low or back to back in adjoining rows, but you and your son could get into the game and see what the old man used to do. And for that reason, they kept about 100 tickets aside for every game for decades. Well, when Brandon steps in, that policy is gone. So you call up Jamie Morris for help with tickets. Jamie had been fired. You call up Marty Bodner for help with the tickets. Marty Bodner had been fired. All right, instead, what you get back is a form email to all Michigan football lettermen saying, if you want tickets for the Notre Dame game, here is the link to StubHub. If you want season tickets to the University of Michigan football games, here's the link for the wait list, which now costs $500 just to be on it. In other words, the fact that you spent your blood, sweat, and tears, and maybe your knees and your hips too in many cases, on this very field means nothing to us. And at that point, if we're simply exploiting these guys, we are now running, in my opinion, a guilty pleasure. So now you've lost the employees, you've lost the lettermen, you'll lose the students next. We might have some recent students here at Michigan. Joe Carriage, by the way, a proud St. Francis Gladiator, as you guys well know, is one of my students. A fine young man, I can tell you, without violating HIPAA, I hope. He's also an excellent, serious student, and of course goes from walk-on to captain at Michigan. Non-athlete students, all of a sudden, they had what's called a general admission seating policy take over after decades of reserved seating. How it used to work forever, of course, when you're a freshman, you sit underneath the scoreboard because, screw you, you're a freshman. But even when you're a freshman, man, you dream of being a sophomore or a junior or a senior because you know you're going to work around that bowl until finally your senior year, and you probably know a few seniors who are sitting on a 30 or 40-yard line, and that's going to be great. We dreamed of that the way you dream of your first license, of course, or your first beer, whatever else. Since, shut up, wherever you are. He has nothing to say about this. So you're dreaming about that. All of a sudden, overnight, the students were told with no warning whatsoever that that policy had been rescinded, and from now on, it's general admission only, which means first comes, first serves, which means if you're a senior waiting for this great senior year, any freshman who wakes up before you do, which your senior year is all of them, you didn't have to work at Rick's to know that one, I don't think. That guy can take your seat. That does not sit very well with a 21-year-old, of course, major at that point. Even worse than that, that was reported somewhat. What was not reported, which I myself did not even realize till I sat down with the student government leaders who protested this, is they also lost the ability to apply for tickets together and sit with your friends. That is something we took so seriously when I was at Michigan. We took that almost as seriously as we did the people are going to be in our house the next year. Who's going to sit with us our junior year? Who's going to sit with us our senior year? You apply together. Back then it was a stapler. Now it's online. All right, and that ability was also lost. All of a sudden, if you were a senior and you did somehow get there before all the freshmen, you're going to be surrounded by 20 freshmen you've never met before. All right, and that is a killer experience for these people. How many of us, honestly, would want to go to a game like that and be surrounded by 20 strangers? As Bill Martin told me, we've got about 50 sections at Michigan. Those aren't 50 sections. Those are about 2,000 neighborhoods that people have been cultivating for years, for decades. You become so close to the people in your section that out of those relationships come invitations to graduations, invitations to actual weddings, all based on 8 Saturdays a year. All right, that's how serious that is. They lost that ability. Now they are ticked off also. Then he loses the faculty next. The faculty, again, were very pro-athletics for many years. There are a lot of great relationships between athletics and the hospital and engineering and law and business and you name it. All that pretty much was severed during a 4-year period. One easy example for this, two friends of mine, Buddy Morehouse and Brian Krueger, were doing a great movie on Willis Ward and Gerald Ford. In 1969, the movie Brian's Song was made about two guys, Brian Piccolo and Gale Sayers, the first two interracial roommates in the history of the NFL. Well, 35 years earlier, Gerald Ford and Willis Ward already did that at Michigan, and there are no movies because no one really cared. They're just best friends. All right, these guys wanted to do a great movie about those guys, so they asked the department for a list of photos. They said, look, we need about 200 photos here. All right, do the Ken Burns thing of photographing those and running those in our cameras, of course, and here's what we need, and what's that going to cost? They got back an estimate about a week later that for those 200 photos, and their whole budget was $170,000, which is a cheap budget, trust me, for a one-hour documentary. The budget for those photos alone, the department said, was going to be $190,000. $1,000 per photo just to take a picture of it. All right, you don't get to keep the photo itself. And these guys were experienced filmmakers. So they said, okay, that's crazy. So they went to Greg Kinney, who runs the Bentley Historical Library on North Campus, right next to the Gerald Ford Library. And they gave him the same list, and they said, okay, what's it going to cost? And a week later, he said, I've got good news. I've got all those photos. I said, okay, what's the punchline? What's it going to cost? And he said, a little less than $190,000, zero, nothing. And they said, how's that possible? And Greg said, easy. We are the University of Michigan, created for one purpose, to support research, teaching, and learning. This is what we do. We're not Domino's Pizza. There, I said it. I'm actually nicer in the book, I swear. So that's how you alienate the faculty, examples like that. The last stop is the Regents. They're the last ones to leave the Brandon bandwagon because they recall him very fondly and rightly as a great Regent. They knew him very well. So they're the last guys to believe all this stuff going on and finally it kind of happened to them as well, vote by vote and issue by issue. One thing that Brandon wanted to do was invest $350 million more than Martin's $400 million to revamp the athletic campus all over again, including tearing up the track, which Jesse Owens in 1935 had set 4 world records on in less than 1 hour. 100-meter dash, 200-meter dash, 220 hurdles, high jump that was not broken for 33 more years until Bob Beamon broke it in Mexico City. And that, of course, held for a long time as well. That is the single greatest hour in the history of athletics from anybody. It is so great that Jesse Owens to this day has got a plaque honoring that achievement right there in a monument outside the track, and Jesse Owens went to Ohio State. That's how impressive that was. So they're down there, of course, and David Brandon's giving the regents a tour of the facilities, trying to explain why they need to tear this up and start anew up the road and needed all this money. But one of the regents he's talking to is Kathy White, Kathy White's father, a great guy I've gotten to know very well as a friend. He was the younger brother of a U.S. Army soldier stationed in Germany in the 50s. Their parents were gone. They had no money. And he was running such good times in the cinder tracks in Germany that the times there got sent across the ocean, of course, to Michigan, and they offered him a scholarship based on that alone. That's how he got to Michigan, and that's how she eventually went to Princeton, where she majored in engineering, earned letters in volleyball and track, ended up becoming a law professor, as well as a regent, as well as a captain in the military. This woman has done a few things, as you might imagine, as well as being a regent naturally. So while this is all going on and this talk is happening, the varsity athletes are all running very fast on the inside two or three tracks, of course, lanes. Outside lanes are being used by the students, kind of jogging along, the professors, and Lord help us all, a few townies. And this is obviously not sitting very well with Dave Brandon, who's getting very irritated about this. And Kathy White cannot resist but ask, you know, this is clearly bothering you. Why is it bothering you? And you know you can't say snobism or elitism is a very good answer. So he thinks about it for a second and he says, liability. Forgetting for a second that she is in fact a law professor who knows more about liability than most of us here in the room probably. And she says, liability? What kind of liability? And he thinks about that for a second and then he says, heart attacks. Right. And she says, heart attacks? You know, right now, people can run across the Diag all day long. They can run through the Arboretum on all the hills there, of course. Every football Saturday, we've got 110,000 people eating bratwurst and burgers and beer all day long. And then climbing up and down 90 rows of stairs. There is your liability. The people on the track are in the best shape of any of them. They're the least likely to have a heart attack. So that's where he loses the regents over things like that.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, more from John U. Bacon.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return now to our program with John U. Bacon.
So now, look at this. You've lost five of your greatest, strongest groups of allies. You've lost who? You've lost the employees, of course, who are gone. You've lost the lettermen who are ticked off, the students mad about the tickets, the faculty about not playing nice with others, and the regents about crazy votes. All right? These are five groups you should have in your back pocket. They're now indifferent or antagonistic towards what you're trying to do. Fast forward to September 29th, that week in September of 2014. The Minnesota game is coming up. On that Monday, they have what's called a retail activation, which goes terribly wrong. Who recalls what the retail activation was? Who knows that one? Coca-Cola, check this out, man. A year later, you guys all still know this one. The deal was very simple. Two Cokes, two tickets for not Appalachian State, but for the Minnesota Brown Jug game, Big Ten opener in Ann Arbor. And that news got to one of my students who helped me do some research in this book, Alejandro Zuniga. He's fantastic. He's at the Michigan Daily. This little sign was at the Michigan Union at one of the convenience stores there. And a friend of his calls him up and tells him about it. Alejandro, being a good reporter, figures this cannot be true, so he walks down the street to this little convenience store in the Union, and he sees the sign. He still does not believe it. So to test the theory, he goes to get two Cokes, pushes them across the table, and he gets two tickets back for the Minnesota game. He can't believe it. So he tweets the sign, and that goes viral, thousands of retweets nationwide, and now Michigan is a national joke yet again. All right, that's a problem there, of course, on that one. Look, at that point, the scarcity principle has gone poof. You can no longer charge anybody $500 to be in a wait list that clearly no longer exists. All right, that's clearly an embarrassment, It's also a problem that Saturday. Most of us, like myself, I've got tickets on the 10-yard line. They're not very good, but they cost me about $2,000 a year. And you go towards the middle, of course, it costs more and more. And I'm sitting there on Saturday, and the guy next to me paid two Sprites.